Dargraith Publishing presents The Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101 for summer semester 2014. Lecture 7, delivered on June 24, 2014. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 1.
Tonight, review for Exam 1, the technicals, 50 questions, multiple guess or multiple choice, and true and false. I could even be a little more specific. True and false. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Looks like 7 true and false. True, false. Then 43 of another kind. Now, what I'm going to do is go through by topic, and then I'm going to get some real specific questions out for you to know. And as always, if you know my teaching style, sometimes I accidentally give you an example that's an actual question on the exam. Once in a while, yeah. A few times. Every test. But I can't tell you that. Yeah. Well, yeah. Go ahead, tell me. I've got them up right now. What one was it?
It was one where it was like the answer, it was the average total cost, like rises or
minimum rises.
Yeah, like I think the answer was that it rise, but I thought it was fall.
Yeah.
Sure.
Hang on here. It could be a mistake, and if it is, I fix it right away. Okay. In the long run, all costs are fixed. If the average variable cost is rising, then average total cost must be rising too. Was that it? There were two different ones. Okay. Oh, it was a multiple choice.
Okay.
If average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. True or false? Okay, hang on. I'm working it. It's cost of the last unit projection. Average variable cost of producing 90 units is $8, and the total cost of producing 90 units is...
That's four.
Yeah, that, you got that one. Almost everyone got that one right. Okay, the marginal cost curve will intersect the average total cost curve when?
No.
Okay. Hang on here. The average, that was that one. The cost of the last unit produced is called the marginal cost. Okay, if average variable cost is rising, then average total cost must be rising too. If average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. No. A firm producing 20 units of output incurs, no. Okay, if the firm is producing at an output level where average total cost per unit is more than the marginal cost of the last unit produced. Okay, let me draw the graph of it here. Okay, now we got our marginal cost curve, which always has that J shape. Now I'm going to draw in the average total cost curve. And the one thing we know is that it bottoms out right at the marginal cost curve. And this is the ATC. Now the AVC would be underneath it like that. So we're saying if the firm is producing at an output level where the average total cost per unit is more than the marginal cost, okay, so on the output axis, we are saying that we're at an output level where the average total cost is more than the marginal cost. Follow me on that. And one very similar to this will be on the exam. This is almost like word for word of one on the exam. Okay, now let's look at what the answers are. Average total cost per unit is rising. No, it's actually falling. You see that, right? Okay, marginal cost per unit is falling. Well, marginal cost never falls. Well, down here maybe. But no, it's rising. Marginal cost, that's the law of increasing marginal cost. Average total cost per unit is falling. Yes, it's falling. Now, let me look at the last answer and see if there was something. Marginal cost per unit is at its minimum. No, no. That's the only one that could possibly be it. Answer would be, say it. Did you? Oh.
Yeah, even though the graph was.
Holy cow.
And that's what I
had. Okay, you wait right here. You're going to get fixed. It's going to be fixed right now. Okay. Hang on here. Let me fix it. Quit bitching at me here. Give me a minute. Oh, okay. So you already corrected. Jesus, Henry, Christ. Okay, if you got the wrong answer, but it was the right answer, send me an email message and I'll fix it for you, okay? I'll just manually override.
The first time I did it, I got it right.
If you...
I totally thought that was the right answer.
It is. That's just an error in the key. That's what I get. That was one of the two that I took out of the test bank. The others I wrote myself, and that was in the test bank wrong. Okay, here we go. If you did give the right answer, but it marked it wrong, just send me an email and I'll just override your score, okay? That's all I need to do.
So what was the answer?
The average total cost is falling. See, you're down here. If marginal cost is below average cost, then average cost is being pulled down by the last unit's cost.
But it says if it's rising.
No, it's not. It says... The question is, if the firm is producing at an output level where average total cost per unit is more than marginal cost, at that output level, the average total cost is more than the marginal cost. Wasn't about rising or falling. Now, let me get something else out here real quick. While I've got all this drawn here on the board, I'm going to draw on the other one, and I'm going to give you a couple of real heavy hints. This is AVC. Well, I've got this up here. Okay, let me get to where I want to find this. Graph it right. Okay. Tell me this. If average total cost is falling, average variable cost must be falling too. Is that right or wrong? Again, if average total cost is falling, does that mean that average variable cost must be falling too?
No.
Look.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay.
It's true.
See, because if, what did I say? If average total cost is falling, look, do you see this? There's a place in the average, right here is that area I was talking about where average total cost is still falling, but average variable cost has actually started to rise. So it's false. That's false. Because there is this little region in here where your average total cost is still coming down, but your average variable cost has actually started to track back upward.
But
yeah. No.
Oh, this one was true.
Now, here's the one on the quiz. Hang on. Here's the one on the quiz. If average variable cost is rising, then average total cost must be rising too. Now, if average variable cost is rising, okay, now let me go to the other one. If average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. Look at this. You see that? If average variable cost is falling, then average total cost is falling. See, because average total cost keeps falling even after average variable cost has started to rise. So if average variable cost is falling, then average total cost is definitely falling. Because that, you're talking about this area in here, and the average total cost is definitely falling if average variable cost is dropping. It's really confusing. You have to read it very carefully. But if you read it too many times, then you're going to you'll get so confused you won't be able to find your own butt using both hands in a roadmap. So let's go through it one more time. I want to make sure that you can get this. I'm going to draw these curves, cost curves, in again. Now you got your marginal cost. Now you got your average total cost curve comes down and it bottoms out at the marginal cost. It comes back up. Average variable cost does the same thing. It bottoms out at the marginal cost, and then it turns upward, and it begins to come in on the average total cost because your average fixed costs are just beginning to decline. So now what we want to do is we want to look at the questions. First one, if average variable cost is rising, that would be this area from here on up, then average total cost must be rising too. What do you say about that? If average variable cost is rising, average total cost must be rising too. False, because there's this small area right here, which is critical in business, because this is your short-run survival area, these outputs in here. Okay? So, yeah, you will have a slight area where average variable cost has started to turn upward, but average total cost is falling. Now the next one, if average variable cost is falling, then average total cost must be falling too. So if average variable cost is falling, average total cost is definitely falling. Because it keeps on falling even after average variable cost started to pull back up. But if average variable cost is falling, there is no question that the average total cost curve is falling too. One thing that I would tell you is on your note card, drawing out the four curves carefully is going to be a good friend of yours. Okay? I will also tell you, however, that all four of the cost curves are on the exam. There are four questions, as I told you before, where all you have to do is label the curves. Which one's average fixed cost, average variable cost, average total cost, marginal cost. All you have to do. So if you can do that, then you have a perfect picture for answering these two difficult questions. And both of them, I'll tell you right now, are going to be on the exam. Oh, yeah, because you see the average. Here, look at this output. Let me draw in here. This is, we usually don't draw in the average fixed cost curve because it's kind of captured in the ATC. But let's say you've got this output level right here. Here's how much your average fixed cost is. Here's how much your average variable cost is. You add those two numbers together, that is your average total cost. So the total is always above those two hanging. So, again, though, on the test, you're going to see a big, nice, big picture, perfectly designed, of course, because it's a computer-generated picture of the four cost curves. The average fixed cost, the marginal cost, and the average variable cost, well, that's a little bit pointy, and the average total cost, which converges on the average variable cost curve at high output levels because the average fixed cost isn't adding it much of anything. You will see that diagram. All you have to do is know how to label it, and then you've got a perfect picture for answering any questions that I could throw at you on rising and falling stuff. Okay, so as a matter of fact, that picture takes up almost, it takes up more than a fourth of one of the pages. So once you get that labeled, what you might want to do is go back and get just nail those four questions right away and then just write the letters, the names in there. Then you could handle about any question I could throw at you. And, yeah, these are complicated. Just the wording drives you crazy on them. And like I said, if you think about it too many times, you're going to get yourself too confused to be able to go on. Now, now that we've gone through that, okay, know what the law of demand says. The law of demand. Understand that the law of demand is about changes in quantity demanded. It isn't about demand curves shifting at all. It's about if the price of a good increases, the quantity demanded decreases. Okay? That's all it is. It's not about shifting. The law of demand, if the price of a good increases, then the quantity demanded decreases. Graphically, all we do is draw that as on quantity price axis, a downward sloping curve. So as the price goes up from P1 to P2, the quantity demanded falls from QD1 to QD2. Price goes up, quantity demanded goes down. Not the demand, the quantity demanded. If I say demand changes, that is something more fundamental. It's as I said, if the price of steak goes up, you'll buy less steak. Not because you suddenly start hating steak. It's just that you can't buy as much of it. For the demand to change, well, let me start with you. Madam, what would cause an demand curve to actually shift one way or the other? Income is the big one. If your income changes, your demand will change. That's a big one. What else could cause the demand curve itself to slide? I'm doing the exam here. This isn't just for academic interest. This is exam stuff. What else could move a demand curve? Yeah, I'm cheap. Yeah, possibly so. That's possible. Some economists would argue actually technically what that's doing is just changing the price of it implicitly. Possibly. Go ahead. What was one?
Expectations.
You can have the demand for something shift outward or inward just because people are expecting something. Like, for example, when a rumor goes around that a product is not going to be available, demand can surge. Another thing is, if a rumor goes around that there's a defect in a product, that can actually shift the demand curve inward. That's a dirty game. It's been around for years, trying to drop rumors about opposition, your competitor's products. And there's been sort of like this effort in recent years at a truce that we don't tell lies about each other's products. But it still happens out there. Rumors, for example, whether they're true or not, that's not the issue. It's whether or not people believe. Like, for example, when you heard that there was a thing some years back, eggs are bad for you. Sure did shift the demand for eggs. Well, now it turns out that doctors say, well, no, that's not really true. Now we have some important changes in demand based upon the concerns about genetically modified organisms. GMO corn, GMO foods are dangerous. And so you're seeing people trying to find ways, even though they're not allowed, even though the law prevents companies from saying that they're non-GMO, people are trying to find out and they're backing away from products that are GMO. So, expectations are a definite one. What else can change? The two other really important ones that can move a demand curve.
Compliments.
Say that?
Compliments
and substitutes will. Look, this is a question on the exam. There are two questions like this on the exam. Watch carefully what I'm doing here. Let me think. T Two substitutes. Kids and happiness. No, let me do something. No, that's controversial. okay, let's do this one. Beef and chicken. Here are their demand curves. Let's say the price of beef goes up. Now, on the beef curve, okay, on the beef curve, what happens? So do I shift the demand curve or do I just slide along it? Slide along it. If you understand that, you're in good shape for this test. Be still, woman. P2, from P1 to P2. Quantity demanded. Simply, the price of a product going up doesn't mean you hate beef. It just means you can't buy as much of it as you used to be able to. So your quantity demanded will slip some. Now, as you buy less beef, are you a vegetarian?
No.
Good. You need meat. You need meat. Well, you're not going to buy as much beef, so what does that mean? You have hurt your income somewhat because you're still going to buy some beef. I mean, who doesn't need a steak every now and then or a burger? But you have freed up some money by buying less beef. At least you freed up a little bit of money. So now your income disposable changes for substitutes. And that's why on the chicken curve, that's right, buck, buck, that's right. Why did the chicken cross the road? Because the price of beef went up. I don't know what the hell that meant, but, you know, go with the flow. Anyway, weirdo. I ought to patent, trademark that. Why did the chicken demand curve cross the road? Because the price of beef went up. Yeah, there you go. There's your damn answer. You see, the price of beef going up drove people away from the amount of beef, but it drove them upward in their demand for things like chicken.
When you split it that way, does that mean that chicken got cheap?
No. Here's this thing that screws you over, and this is just consumer choice theory. If I were to put in a supply curve here, all that's happening is that as you bail off the beef, you're just going to move over and drive up the price of chicken. So you're screwed any way you cut it. You see that, right? As you pull away from the beef, you're going to run toward substitutes. But as you run toward them, that in itself is going to push their prices up too. Recently, there have been a couple of different slaughter animals. The price of them went up, and as people pulled away from them, they headed for chicken. And that was exactly what happened was, as the demand for chicken pushed upward, well, the price of chicken, it didn't go up a lot because the supply curve was pretty elastic. There are a lot of chickens out there, and they're easy to reproduce at a very high rate. In other words, replacement of chickens is a very short cycle. But it still did push the price of chicken up. But people definitely, we see it happen. Interestingly enough, though, with some demand curves, they are so price inelastic that, I mean, you, like, for example, one that just amazes us is coffee. Coffee is such a steep demand curve. I mean, the price of that stuff can go up stupidly. And the price elasticity of demand is so heavy, steep downward sloping, that hardly any less coffee is purchased. So the complements, or rather the substitutes, I mean, you know, Here, what's a substitute for coffee? Classic one is tea. But the demand for tea is actually fairly price elastic. And what happens is that there is very, very little shift outward in the demand for tea because people haven't really moved very much away from coffee. So in other words, when you've got steep curves like this, the shift in the complement's demand curve is very small. Shallower demand curves, like for beef, the shift is more noticeable. But for coffee, you know, you can have essentially an apocalypse in South America, and prices can double, won't do anything to the demand, the quantity demand, to the quantity demanded. And so there is very little secondary effect on tea prices, on tea demand at all. Interestingly, there was a surge upward in the price of coffee last year. And now, as the new crop has come in, what happened was that the price dropped back down. But interestingly enough, the quantity demanded didn't go up very much because people never walked away from it. They still bought it, so there wasn't really any response back the other way. To give you an idea, Folgers 100% Colombian 16-ounce can went up to, skyrocketed to almost $13 here in this area. And then this year, it slid back down. Right now, it's at about $6.42 for the 16 ounces. But the quantity demanded, I mean, it's just so small, the shifts, that you hardly notice them. To get people to really back off a product like that, you have to have the price skyrocket. I mean, terribly. I'm going to ask you something here. Oh, and of course, complements go the other way. Complements feed each other. So, for example, those were what I did here was all substitutes. Things that you can go to if you don't want the other product because the price has gone up. You don't want as much of it. So here's complements. Two demand curves. Q, dollars. Okay, so now let's do some complements on each other. Gasoline, no, bad example. Too highly elastic for that. The heck with that. So we'll do something else. Okay, well, we'll just do one like this. Cereal and milk. There's one in the book, by the way, a topic you might have run across that I didn't cover. It's called cross-price elasticities of demand. This is the metric we use to find out just how powerful the link is between products. We do a lot of market research to find out cross-price elasticities. And usually they make a lot of sense. Cereal, milk, highly correlated. Cross-price elasticity is positive and strong. Coffee and tea. They are correlated. Cross-price elasticity is negative and very weak. A lot of them make sense. Sometimes we run into these cross-price elasticities and we say, what? Why is that strong? There's no connection. And then we have to figure out why people have a cross-price elasticity. Okay, now, let's say that the price of grain cereals that you use milk with goes up from P1 to P2. Now, all that means for cereal is that the quantity demanded of the cereal is going to slide downward. The quantity demanded, you're just going to ride along that. However, because you are buying less cereal, you need less milk. And that's a need thing. So what that's going to do is that's going to need moves a demand curve. Need moves a demand curve. Remember that. As you buy less cereal, You need less milk. And again, if you're talking about need, then you're talking about a demand curve moving. Sir, when you were 5 years old, did you need porn?
No, I did not.
So your demand curve was very low, right?
Right.
You were not an early achiever.
No.
Good. When you got to 18, don't look at me like that. I know damn well your demand curve shifted.
Yeah,
that mofo shifted out there into the universe somewhere. Yeah. Need drives demand, okay? Real problems for real people. Okay, now, the cereal. So this would mean that the actual demand curve has shifted inward. Okay? And this is one of those things where it's really important for companies, and I brought this up before. You want to create complements and substitutes for your products within your own class of product, within your own company. If I have a series of products, what can happen is, okay, I have to bring up the price of cereal. So, or the price of cereal is going to go up. I'm a dairy producer. Okay, then, if I'm a dairy producer, I know that when the price of cereal goes up, demand for my milk is going to go down. So what I would want to do is make sure that I had other products in my inventory so that I could let people go over to those if they wanted less milk, things that were not that they could move to if they were buying less milk. We also we know there are a lot of things also with complements and substitutes. We know that if we have to jack up the price of one product, what we have to do is also provide for people to buy substitutes for it within our family of products in our company. Buying under different labels, we can probably provide for them something that will replace what's temporarily gone up in price. And they won't even know that they're buying in the same family of products. We'll have a different brand name on it, probably a different label, and all of that. Just know this rule of substitutes and complements. Okay. When my income goes up, I buy a little bit more milk, let's say. What kind of a good is it if when my income goes up, I buy a little bit more of it? That's a normal good. That would be a good where the price elasticity is somewhere between 0 and 1. If my income goes up a little and my demand for something goes up a lot, that's a superior or a luxury good. Either one you can call it. In other words, the income elasticity of demand is greater than 1. There's a more than 1-for-1 response. But if my income goes up and my demand for something goes down, that's an inferior good. And that's one of those products, in other words, it's a poor people's product. Mad Dog, ramen noodles. They don't even make Ripple anymore, do they? Oh well, good times. White Castles. Interestingly enough, there are convenience foods that are actually inferior goods. And a number of products that we think, one of the fascinating things in this topical area is the old canard that used to be, well, I saw these people on food stamps and they were buying ice cream and they were buying potato chips, blah, blah, blah. I work for a living and these welfare queens and all this, they're buying these things. Well, actually, my first, you know, being an academic, I want to explain to them in reasonable terms what's going on. So the first thing I say is STFU. And then after I've done that, I say, here's the thing. You see, foods like those pack incredible calories and fat into the package. So if you are hungry and you have the choice between a nutritious, low-fat, low-calorie diet prepared in your own home and a box of ice cream that's got a huge number of calories and a high fat content to blow calories into your system to keep you going for the day, and you have the money for that, you're going to buy the ice cream. You're not going to go for the fancy stuff. In other words, some of these snack and convenience foods are actually inferior goods because poor people need to use the few dollars they have to buy as many calories as they can to get to the next day, period. So that's why you'll see poor people buying convenience foods, actually disproportionately to rich people who will buy nutritious, healthy, all natural, organic, indeed, they won't even make you fart, foods. Interesting little twist there. Okay, let me go on with a few more things here. What else could I tell you? I'm going to do you're going to see this graph on the exam. These are demand curves. Two demand curves where on each of the graphs. One graph has two demand curves where you have from point A to point B, the first demand curve is A, and then the second one, you're going in the opposite direction, and then we have this will put hair on your chest, but let's go through it. I'm going to have this, and you're going to have a couple of questions, okay? All right. So, let's try an easy one. The price of this good went up. Which one is it, A, B, C, or D? B. Do you see that? The price of the good went up. So all you're going to do is slide along the demand curve. Now, by the way, these are normal good. This is a normal good. Income increased. Which one is that? As in doggy. Now, let's go on to another one. Here's where it can get a little bit more trickier for you. Let's say that this product has a complement and the price of the complement increased. This product has a complement and the price of that complement increased. What will this do for the product under consideration? C, you make my heart warm and my pants damp. That was incredible. The price of the complement increased. So the quantity demanded of the complement went down, which drove the demand for this product, down. I am impressed. You got a couple. If you can do what I just did there, you got a couple on the exam. Okay, let's try a few other happy things here before we take a break. Costs of change are called what? Costs of change with output are called what? Costs that change are called variable costs. They vary. Costs that don't change are called fixed. The cost of the last unit is called marginal cost. The cost of the best foregone alternative is called opportunity cost. Mumble at me. Opportunity cost. Get that one tattooed on you. The cost of the best foregone alternative. Here's one that you'll probably struggle with. Someone says that you, direct historical costs are called. This one's a little tricky. This one's quite tricky, actually. Direct historical costs are called. Well, they're called, no, they're called sunk costs, but there's another name for them too. They're called accounting costs. Isn't that interesting? Which is bigger, accounting profit or economic profit? Again, which is bigger, accounting profit or economic profit? Accounting profit. Because accounting profit does not include hidden costs, opportunity costs. Economics, we have to talk about those costs. We have to talk about what you give up, not just what you pay, but what you give up. Which means that profit from an economic standpoint is much lower than accounting profit. I can run an accounting profit and I can still walk away from my business. If I'm not making enough to pay my to compensate me for what I'm doing instead of something else. So economic profit, what really drives business decision making, is not nearly as big as accounting profit is. Always keep that in mind when someone's trying to convince you to buy stock. Well, this company's had profit the last 20 years. Look at that profit and ask yourself, is that enough to cover the risks of this investment? Yeah, I mean, if I, well, anyway, I won't fart on that for right now. Let's start. Okay. ...3D printers are now replacing at a scary rate traditional manufacturing techniques. We can build even things as big as jet engines. Soon we'll be able to build complete airplanes. We'll be able to build many things just with 3D printers that used to be going down an assembly line and all that. Now, this is going to reduce costs incredibly in businesses. It's also going to cost a huge number of jobs, and that'll probably lead to some kind of at least radical social movement, possibly a revolt. But one way or the other, costs are going to go down. What do we call this kind of efficiency? Bingo. Excellent. It's dynamic efficiency. Moving from one technology to another technology to reduce costs. Now, interestingly, you saw the dynamic efficiency when automobiles began to replace the horse and buggy carriages. They really weren't all that impressive, the dynamic efficiency wasn't. And the truth be told, people really didn't want cars. I mean, they were like a novelty for years until one of the, I guess I told you the story, one of the car manufacturers figured out, oh, if we're going to get people to buy these expensive contraptions, we're going to have to get them to stop using trolleys and electric trains and all of those things that people used. And so the company bought up all the electric lines, the trolleys and all that, and trashed them. And that forced these people to have to buy cars if they wanted to get to work. Yeah. Anyway, what do you call the extra happiness you get from eating another one more cheeseburger? Marginal utility. What do you call the total happiness you get from eating 10 cheeseburgers? Total utility. Yeah. You, of all people, you were the subject of the experiment. We put the joy meter on your thigh. You should be remembering this. Okay, tell me what the two, if, okay, What are the two conditions for a good or service to be a public good? What was the one you said? Oh, no, no, no. Is zero, yeah. That it doesn't cost any more for one more person to enjoy the good, to consume it. In other words, it's like a sunset. It doesn't cost any more for one more person to look at it. A radio station, it doesn't cost anything for another person, one more person to listen to it. This classroom, having one more student sit in a seat, costs nothing. A road costs, one more car on the road costs nothing. But we do have a problem, and I want to make sure that this is in your notes because it might have slipped by me. Public goods have to be paid for because there's a huge cost to some of them. Like a road, even though it doesn't cost any more for one more person to use it, a road costs a lot of money to build. So what we have to do is find a way for to pay for it. Now, the two ways are usually through some kind of a tax or through some kind of upstream advertising revenue or something like that. But there's a problem with people who can actually use the good who are not participating in paying for it. Like, for example, a bicyclist on a highway. You see, we all pay for the highways through our taxes, especially our gasoline tax. But a bicyclist doesn't use gasoline, so the bicyclist is a free rider. A free rider. Someone who lives out in the country where there isn't a school district, who trots his kids into, let's say, Unit 5, that person's kids are free riders because the parents are paying no property taxes for the benefit of their kids using the public good. So the free rider problem has to have ways to, you have to exclude those kinds of people one way or the other through enforcement mechanisms of some kind. We just can't let them use the good if they haven't participated in paying for it. Okay, so remember that free rider problem. But that's a public good. Now, let's talk about some other things. Give me an example of a demerit good. Heroin. Why is it a demerit good? First, what's necessary? In order for it to be a demerit good, it has to have a negative externality. Bingo. But not all demerit goods, but not all negative externalities create demerit goods. Only those that have a strong negative externality. In the case of heroin, the sentiment has been for over a century that the negative externality is so severe that it must be banned or nearly banned. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so you said that like for it to be demerit, it has to have a strong negative externality.
Yeah.
Negative externalities don't have to be demerit.
That's right. Okay, here's one. Ma'am, have you ever farted? Yes. Okay. Is there a law against it?
No.
It's a negative externality. I mean, people have suffered, possibly died. God knows they have in my car. 50 miles an hour wasn't enough to keep that son of a bitch from bailing that one night. Anyway. Okay, but you see, it has to be so strong that it stopped, that the government has to step in. Yeah, go ahead. You're.
So all demerit goods are negative externalities?
All demerit goods have a strong negative externality. But just because a good has a negative externality doesn't make it a demerit good. The negative externality has to be so strong that the government steps in. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
Did you say there are two requirements for something to be a public good?
Oh, public good. It has to be, you can't, if one person has it, everyone has it. That was the other one. I forgot. Yes. In other words, I can't keep people from having it. I mean, it's like this guy over here. I mean, he's got a gorgeous face. We can't keep the any ladies from seeing it. They all see it. So you just have to share it and live with the consequences. You cougar hound, you. I know. Okay, give me a good... yeah, go ahead. You can't, if one person has it, then it ends up everyone can get it. Everyone can have it.
But, well, then what were you talking about with, like, the exclusions, like a biker?
Oh, okay. If we, the only problem with public goods is that we want everyone to pay for it who's going to enjoy it, and we can't keep people from, unless there's some way we can stop those who don't pay for it, and that requires serious measures. Laws, usually... in some cases, structural barriers. Because on its own, the public good is just going to be everyone's. It's just going to be there. So if we want people not to have it, if we want to stop free riders, we have to do some pretty serious things to stop them. Yeah, go ahead.
I thought if something's a public good, then you can't exclude anyone.
Well, that's on its own... By its nature, it has no exclusion. By its nature, it doesn't have an exclusion. If we exclude someone, we have to go to some serious lengths. For example, you ever driven down the highway and they have this sign that says no bicyclists? Have you ever seen it on highways? The reason they do that is not because of the safety issue. It's because of the free rider problem. And it's, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so you just want us to be aware of the free rider problem.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not pushing it right now. We will get back to it later in the course, though, but I do want you to understand. On their own, public goods have this feature that they're everyone's. And if we don't want them to be everyone's because some people aren't paying for them, we have to go to some pretty extraordinary measures to keep the free riders out. Like, for example, with radio stations, they were a pure public good by their nature. Anyone who had a radio could listen. So what was the solution that was, and television was the first one to do that. What was the television network's solution? First it was advertising to pay for it, and then what did they go to? Cable. So they created an exclusionary structure around something that by its nature didn't have an exclusionary principle. We actually recreated the good. They tried to do that with radio, but it never caught on the way it did with with XM Sirius, but it never caught on like cable did. Do any of you have a television that's not cable now? Somehow that doesn't surprise me, but that's because you live in a hovel. But interestingly enough, radio stations, this was the brilliant thing. It worked with cable. We're going to have this work with, radio too. It never caught on. And there's been a lot of debate on why it didn't catch on. Here's the thinking about it was that television stations were actually, there were not too many in any given market. 1, 2, 3, 4 in any given market. So they were easier to control and bring under an exclusionary principle. There were fewer cats to herd. But when you're talking about radio stations, there are dozens that you can hear in any given area. Well, not to any given area. I've been in some areas of South Dakota where we were lucky to get one, and that preacher sucked. But that was the problem was radio stations are so common that there was not a way to herd them together to get them to all create an exclusionary principle against the public good aspect. That's the best we can do about it. So fortunately, we'll still have free radio unless you're really into XM and all of that kind of stuff. But people put up with the advertising. One more thing before I give you a break. Let me go back to some origins of the class. You remember that first night back long ago when we were young, we were in love, we were happy. Yeah, those were good times. Give me one word that captures why we study economics. One word starts with an S.
Sacrifice.
Stupid. No! Say it. Someone pat him on the buttock. Yes! It's scarcity. Economics is the study of how different societies, people, households, businesses deal with a world of scarcity. Because nothing is free. Nothing in the world is free. And so we study what people and businesses and societies and nations do in the presence of scarcity. Now, there are three different broad economic approaches that societies try. Do you remember the three different systems of dealing with scarcity? Traditional, command, market. Now, in a traditional, the scarcity is dealt with. Things that are scarce are allocated among the competing possible uses through customs, traditions, and common law. Now, in command economies, it's the scarcity, how we allocate scarce resources among competing end uses, possible end uses, is usually done through some kind of authority, some command figure or a committee or a leader, a strong man, Russia, in the Soviet Russia, there was the Politburo and all of its apparatchiks and departments and agencies. In communist China, you have traditionally, in Red China, you had the allocation by essentially this inner circle and all of its command apparatchiks. Now, in a free market, in a market economy, what allocates the scarce resources among possible uses? It's the invisible hand. Adam Smith called it the invisible hand. What is that?
Prices.
In other words, there's no ruler or no tradition. It's just if you can afford it, you can have it. If you're going to make it cheap and find cheaper ways through static efficiency and dynamic efficiency. The three questions any society has to ask: what to produce, how to produce it, and for whom to produce it. So, for example, let me give you a quote from an ancient society. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. What kind of a society would that be? This ancient society said, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Which one of them is it? It's actually, that would be traditional because it had been handed down as Talmudic law. That's an Old Testament statement from Genesis. That was the rule of the Hebrew tribes. From each according to his, that was how it was done. Now, as the society advanced, as you approach the turn of the from BC to AD, from before Christo to Anno Domini, you had a change. The society's rule began to be, as the Sadducees have decreed, so shall you have. What would that be? A command. That would be a command. Central authority. You see, the rabbis, they didn't like this idea at all. They liked the old idea, and they were constantly battling them. And the Sadducees were in cahoots with the Romans, and they would just, every time these rabbis would start trouble, let's go back to the old way, not to this thing with the Sadducees and the Pharisees, they'd have the Romans kill them. That was done over and over again. So you have these attempts to move a society forward. And interestingly enough, oftentimes you see movement from a traditional to a command, because a command can lay down a fist and say, no more tradition. You do it our way, and if you don't, we'll kill you. And then you move a lot farther into historical times, and you see, for example, the price mechanism starting to bite in very hard in the Middle Ages with the trade guilds. You want what we have, rich people? You got to pay us for it. And if you can, we'll give it to you. If you can't, then you can kiss my ass. And that was where we began to see that tradition of the market economy starting to show up very strongly. Although they were around quite a bit, even in ancient times, price mechanisms were working. Why don't you take a break for a few minutes here? Back to the exam. Here we go. Now, there will be one or two questions on agency and on contract. Okay, agency. Make sure you know what the types of costs are, what the agency costs are. There are four distinct types. Make sure you know the four types. They should be in your notes and in the PowerPoint. Now, fiduciary relationships. Make sure you know about fiduciary duty. There are three characteristics. Make sure you know the three characteristics of fiduciary duty. They're in that PowerPoint as well, and I also gave them in the lecture. Just know them, and you got yourself a question. Now, there'll be a question on contract. I'm going to describe a transaction, and I'm going to give you a list of terms, and you have to find the term that does not apply to this contract. So, let's try. Okay, here's one. You go in. You decide that you're going to go get your nails done. So you walk in, and you sit down, and I am your manicurist, and I say, well, there you are again. Let's see those. Oh, my God, what have you been doing to those nails? You've been eating raw meat again. You've been trying to be butch. Looks like you tried to work on a car or something. Come on back. We'll fix you up. Come on. You take care of, and I take care of your nails. And you pay me, and you're on your way to looking fabulous again. Tiger. Okay, now, I'm going to say some words. You tell me yes or no. Expressed. No. And she says, no. Well, no. That's different. Okay, this was expressed versus implied. In other words, did I say, wherefore, the party of the first part shall be made fabulous by the party of the second part for said fee and all of that? There was nothing like that. We had an implied contract. Okay. Written? Oral? It's oral. We didn't write a contract. We didn't sign anything. It's an oral contract. Okay. it's not expressed. It's implied. Is it implied? What kind of implied? There are two kinds of implied. What are they? Implied in law and implied in, which one is this? Fact. There's no written law, manicurist shall be paid. It's implied in fact. Okay, now, Bilateral. Is it bilateral or is it unilateral? Tell me. Say it. It's unilateral. Because a bilateral, you will pay me $50 and I will do your nails. No, it's unilateral. If I do your nails, you'll pay me. Okay, so it's not, both parties are not off the bat obligated. Yes.
Okay, so is that like the big difference then between like unilateral
and bilateral? Because I'm just getting
confused. So it's like unilateral, like not both parties are obligated.
Immediately.
Okay, but in bilateral they are.
They are, yeah. A bilateral example would be one where most employment contracts are bilateral. You have to perform your duties and I have to pay you. But if I don't pay you, you can't just say I'm not going to work because I can fire you. You didn't know that, did you? I mean, there's technically, you can't just not work if I don't pay you, if there's some problem with pay schedules or the computer breaks down. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to come to work until my paycheck shows up. It doesn't work that way. It's a bilateral. Let's try another bilateral. There are a number of examples of bilateral contracts out there, but employment is one of the more common ones, typical kinds of employment. However, there are other ones out there too. For example, interestingly enough, a lot of financial planners, what you're getting is actually a bilateral contract. They will provide services for you, and you will give them a cut of what they make, okay? Because they could give, and you can't get out from under it, but they don't have to really provide you with much of anything, and most of them don't, but you still have to pay them. Now, they have to give you financial advice, and they'll take the money. You don't have any choice as to whether they'll take money out of the earnings. They'll just take it. In fact, interestingly enough, these days, do any of you have automatic bill pay of any kind? Those they've suckered you. Those are bilateral contracts because you see, have you ever had your internet service not work? Did you refuse to pay your bill? They'll still be able to take, yeah, but they'll still be able to take your money out. If they miss, like for example, Comcast, I was dead for a week. They still took the full fee out on my Comcast line.
You don't have
the
mouth by that.
Huh? Because
the dish, my cable was out for like 3 days. My dish was out for 3 days. He was like, well, this is your bill and this is what it's due. And I get mine paid like that. And I stopped the payment that day. And he called me and I called him and told him that it wasn't working. He was like, well, okay, this will be credited to your account.
Okay. Bingo, absolutely. However, they were going to take out the full amount, weren't they?
Yeah, they would.
That's bilateral. In other words, you had to negotiate an amendment to the contract. Automatically, though, if my Verizon phone isn't working for a few days, they'll still take the full amount out. If you want to bitch at them, what you're doing is seeking an amendment to the original contract. But the original contract, they will provide service and you will pay them. That's all there is to it. That's how it works. So those are all, they've pulled this now with these bill pays. It's all by subscription. Those are bilateral of their nature. Okay, now one more thing about contracts. Let's make sure that, okay, I have, I got kind of a thing for you. So at the end of the semester, I give you an A.
Sounds good.
And now let's talk. Biagi's. Great Italian restaurant. What do you say? You know? YMCA afterwards. exercise. It's leg day. No, you're going to say no, you weird human scumbag. You owe me. I gave you an A. You owe me. Does he?
No.
Why not? Two reasons. There's a contract there. Is there a contract there?
No.
Why not? Two reasons. No meeting of minds. What's the issue? There was no meeting of minds. There's no question about that. There was no offer, and therefore there could be no acceptance. He didn't refuse the grade, but not refusing is not the same as accepting. Understand that. Not refusing is not the same as accepting. So, the first problem is that there was no offer and acceptance. The second problem is that there was no agreement to mutual consideration. In other words, there was no firm connection between thing of value and thing of value. I gave him a thing of value, but his thing of value was not negotiated when the thing of value from my was worked out. Okay, now there's actually a third one too, legality. Yeah, go ahead. There was no understanding of mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Okay, now, and also again, legality would be an issue there too. You cannot, in most jurisdictions, contract for romance. In fact, that's generally considered against public policy. Contracts for sex and for sexual services are considered against public policy. They are demerit goods. And they are such high demerit goods that they have the highest level of government intervention. What is that highest level? Outright ban. In other words, demerit goods can go through what's the lightest level for a demerit good? Propaganda. Just government bitching. Oh, this is bad for you. Now, that was what was done for years with cigarettes. Then they stepped it up to a higher level. What's the second level?
Taxation.
And then the third level is law, banning it. Or otherwise restricting it in some very serious way. So you see some goods that they will outright ban. Like, for example, what are goods that rise? Okay, first of all, what demerit goods have just a propaganda campaign? No. Oh, no, they're well beyond that. Huh? I would say unhealthy foods because they don't tax unhealthy foods. Well, they do on snack foods, but that's poor people stuff. And again, you screw the poor people because they don't have political power. But it's generally speaking, it's just bitching at you about unhealthy foods. What else is at the level of propaganda right now? Come on, there are a lot of them. I'll tell you one that's been bitched at you up and down since you were kids, unprotected sex. It's a propaganda campaign. They see it as demerit good. And that's just, in other words, there's a negative externality. Well, there are two negative externalities, transmission of sexually venereal diseases, and also there is the potential for those unwanted pregnancies. So it's at the level of a propaganda. Now, are they going to be able to take it beyond that level?
They can't control
Actually, they might be able to. Well, you know what? If they want to watch, you know, it's. But anyway, no. They could actually, there have been proposals, mostly rejected so far, but proposals to assess fines for pregnancies out of wedlock. Specifically, in other words, on the male for causing the pregnancy, to identify him and to fine him. And so that's why I'm changing my name several times in the next year or two. Where the hell was I? Okay, now, anything else rise to the level of just pure propaganda right now?
All that is a violation of our civil liberties.
Well, there's the thing is, in my time, a lot of the things you guys accept as just the way it is, we would have shot people for. Now everyone says, oh, that's cool. Who cares? Okay, now let's go to the level of outright ban. What things, can you give me some examples that are outright banned by law? What is? What was yours? Prostitution. Except in some districts. What else? Texting and driving. Interestingly enough, that is law now, isn't it? You can't text and drive now. Okay. You can do that voice thing, but every time I try to talk into my text message, it comes out in like Yeti. What else? A number of drugs, psychotropic drugs, LSD, a number of stimulants along the lines of methamphetamines, crystal meth, the whole nine yards, ecstasy, synthetics. Marijuana is interestingly backing off nowadays simply because it's not dangerous enough that we can't just tax the stuff and make a lot of money off potheads, which is okay because they're too stoned to notice the money's missing. But what else? Yeah.
I just have a question.
Yeah. Remember, good could be bad. It is actually a behavior. Now, interestingly enough, I have read a number of more right-wing conservative economists who have made the valid point that we have slipped our terminology to the point where now we consider behaviors to be actual commodities. And they say that's a dangerous slope because that means that then the government can say, this is a good, and therefore we can control that good. Instead of only things that you physically can hold or services, now we've slipped the terminology so that the government considers just pure behaviors to be almost like things, and therefore they can make laws on them. Sure would. Isn't that interesting? Because it fits. We can talk about texting and driving as a good, and in fact, it's probably an inferior good. Lower class people will do more texting and driving than upper class people will, because upper class people could afford other ways to do it or to communicate. But also, interestingly enough, with respect to pornography. Pornography in general is considered, has a negative externality. The threshold is that some types of pornography are banned by law. For example, bestiality, necrophilia, child pornography are outright banned. But again, the question that some economists have is, you're banning something that is just an image. If I look at something, I'm breaking a law about a good. So is that really something that government should be doing? But we can deal with it economically. Yeah, these are inferior goods. Almost all these things, these behaviors that are being banned are inferior goods. And so, surprise, surprise, that's where the government aims its bans. Let me get back to the test here. I want to do a couple of quick things here. Layout. Huh? Yep. Well, true and false. Yeah. Okay. equilibrium price and equilibrium quantity. Okay, now. You'll see something like that. It won't look exactly like that, but it'll be close. Okay, where is consumer surplus? Excellent. Where is producer surplus? You know that. You got one on the test. You got that one. See, you're not going to go home empty-handed. Mom will be glad to put this on the fridge. Okay, what does a perfectly elastic demand curve look like?
Horizontal.
Horizontal, right? Vertical is perfectly inelastic. Okay, now, as far as supply curves go, if something is out there that can never be replaced, there's just a set of them, a Picasso or a 1872 French wine or a sculpture by a famous sculptor, what does the supply curve look like? Say, and what shape does that? Perfectly inelastic, which means it is vertical. Right? You know that? You got another one or two on the exam. If it's perfectly, if there's only a fixed number of them and it can never be reproduced, in other words, you cannot replace them, then the supply curve is perfectly inelastic.
So a horizontal would be perfectly elastic.
Elastic.
What would be something that's perfectly elastic?
The supply of dumb labor, because there's so much of it that that essentially, there's no higher wage for hiring more because there's always enough people from Decatur to, Yeah, yes.
It's vertical. Inelastic
is vertical. No, I was talking about, she asked about perfectly elastic. Yeah, she was asking for an example of a perfectly elastic supply curve. And that the classic example of that is unskilled labor. Because there are 7 billion people that can supply it. Essentially, no matter how much is needed, you don't have to pay the last worker any more than enough to keep the worker basically alive. That's why you want to go to school, because then you get to join supply curves that are upward sloping. And the more skill you have that hardly anyone else has, the steeper your supply, the supply curve will be. You can always, you will always be, always, everyone will always be on this perfectly elastic supply curve of brute force labor. And no matter how much of it is needed, no matter where the demand curve is, you don't have to pay any more. See how if the demand for those kinds of people is there, you can pay a subsistence wage. The demand curve is there. You still don't have to pay any more because there are 7 billion people on Earth. All of us can do that kind of dumb labor. So your goal as you are going through school, taking, learning new skills on your own through certification tests and training, you are trying, you will always be on this curve, but what you're trying to do is also get yourself on a supply curve that's not quite so elastic. And the more and the fewer the people out there who can do these things that you're doing, the more inelastic the supply curve is, the last curve, the marginal curve you're on. Now, if you want to work in a dumb job, you can, no matter how much training you got. Your job is to find the marginal supply curve that gets you the most if someone wants it. So if you hear everyone is going into this field, that's a sure sign that you've got a problem. And it's even if you think you're the first in, oh man, I'm getting in on the shockwave of this new technology that's coming, guarantee you that as time goes on, more and more idiots are going to get into it and they're going to flatten the supply curve as more people go into that field. That's what happened with computer programming in the 80s and 90s. First, a few real intelligent geeks and nerds got in, and then more and more people got in, and the learning curve got easier because they did things a lot more in the back room so that people didn't have to know, have as much native intelligence to get degrees. Now you can virtually, literally, you can write games and be not very smart. You don't have to be a brilliant programmer like you did 10 years ago. Okay, moving on. Okay. I was just curious. I decided that I would raise the prices on my artwork. Now, of course, what's going to happen when I raise prices? What happens to the quantity demanded? Goes down. That's a law of demand. That's just reality. But I found out that, interestingly enough, my revenues went up. I lost customers, but interestingly enough, I made more money off the customers who stayed because I jacked my prices up. What can you say about the price elasticity of demand? Where I was pricing. Which means that when I raised my price, of course I lost customers, but my revenue went up. So my demand, where I was on my on the demand curve, my customers were price inelastic because they didn't react that much to the price increase. I lost some, but their reaction was small compared to the price increase. So if my revenues go up when I raise my price, I must have been in the price inelastic portion of the demand curve of my customers. Remember that on there. And I drew you a picture of that, and I'm going to draw it right here now. Study it. Make sure that you understand it. On the axis for price against total revenue, the curve looks like this. We don't know the exact shape. They're all going to be different. Some of them are skewed one way or the other. But the first thing I know is that a price of zero, I'm going to get no revenue. And I also know that there's a price that is so high that no one's going to buy my stuff. All the action is in the middle. On this side, if I am raising my price and my total revenue is going up, demand is price inelastic. In other words, E is less than 1. The price elasticity of demand. By the way, I've got a formula sheet. The last page of this exam has these formulas on it, but I realized I'm still using my old notation, Greek letter instead of the E. It's a Greek letter, but it's there, those formulas. If, when I raise my price, I lose revenue, that means that my customers are peeing themselves about the price increase, so I must be in this region. The demand curve is price elastic. In other words, E is greater than 1. And right in the middle is the unit elastic point where we have exactly E equals 1. What do I call that? Price point. That's a perfect spot where you can't raise or lower your price and do any better than where you are. And as I told you before, companies try very hard to probe, to learn that price point. And if they believe strongly, if they have good evidence, I shouldn't say believe, if they have good evidence that they have found it, they will latch on to it and they'll stay on that price point for years at a time. Wendy's 99-cent value meal, the ice cream company that I told you about. You'll even walk around a store and you'll notice that some products, the price just seems to always be the same. I'm trying to remember what it was I saw like that just yesterday, the price seems to have been that for years, and that's a price point. They are not going to let that go, even if their costs go up, because they know the customers are very sensitive, and right there is where they're happy. Make sure you know that. If you know that, you got two questions. Can't believe I'm just like handing out candy tonight. Bite me. It's on the podcast. I hope I'm recording. Yeah, I'm recording. HCC-prof.com.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on. Let me. No, you can't get it on iTunes. I don't think iTunes has picked it up yet, have they?
No, the ISU one will go.
Yeah, I know, but the I'm working with iTunes right now to bring back my podcast, but they're not doing it. However, I'm going to show you something right here if I can do this real quick. Hang on. Okay, let me kill off this real quick. I'm going to turn on the projector real quick. Press to begin. PC. Okay, sign out. Okay. Now I'm going to show you what you can do here. HTTP. I can't see. : HCCprof.com. Okay. Well, it should be showing here in a minute. Hang on. Like I said, iTunes is not still, hasn't recovered and is picking up Heartland yet, apparently. Let me check real quick and just in case they allow. Is it there? Huh? I sure as heck can't. Can't. When I first started, look, I started doing this back in the mid-2000s, and they started bitching at me here, talking about how they didn't want me doing this. First of all, they said, well, podcasting isn't that popular. It never is. It's never going to be, and we don't want the liability that is associated with this, you doing podcasts. And so they told me to stop doing them, and I didn't go too far, but I essentially ignored them. Come on. It isn't there. That just rotates my ass. God. Okay, let me back this off here.
I got there, but I can't play the...
Well, that's okay. Well, let's try it again. Let me go to HTTP. HCC. Really? There we go. Okay, now, what you can do is this. You can actually click on this, and it will play it in your own computer's media player, and then you can just save the file that way if you want to. Otherwise, if you play it in the Flash player, if you're using, I don't know if it'll work in Internet Explorer, but oh, shut up. Yeah. Internet Explorer. Yeah, use Opera or Safari. Don't use. Yeah, don't use Firefox, for God's sake. The NSA's browser. That was really creepy. That just pissed me off. Try this. Let's try it this way. Yeah. Okay, now what will happen is it'll actually load the MP3 file. And then you can save it. It'll play it in Windows Media Player or whatever you've got, QuickTime. And you can save the file that way as an MP3. And then you can do whatever you want. You can go jogging with your MP3 player. You know, you can go to a restaurant and have your friends listen to it with you and have a good time. Or not. Okay, maybe not. I warn you, these are big, huge files. So, of course, these are like 2-hour, 3-hour lectures. But it'll still work. Yep, shot that sucker. Okay, now let me try something here.
Dark Ray Publishing presents
Oh, shut up. You know what? Bite me. Kiss my ass. Assholes. Where are we? Actually, what if you're in not in Internet Explorer, if you're in an actual browser, you should be able to right-click, and it will actually offer you the chance to save the MP3 file from the Flash player as well, I think. At least I tried to set it up that way. But anyway, one way or the other, you can click it this way and just let it download. It's a huge file, so it's going to download to your computer, and then you can just save it from the media player that you used in your computer. You can do it that way. And then you can take them anywhere you want, each and every lecture. And no one has, wait, no, two people have gone into the game room and played games. But a lot of you, you're missing a chance for something really nice. I mean, I did this for you, and this is how you thank me? Yeah, and no more of those weird people following me on Twitter. God, that was creepy, that one person. Anyway, yeah.
Actually, you would have to do right-click on the link where it says principal. Yeah, right-click, and then save link, save target as.
All that does is save the address, doesn't it? Really?
Yeah, it does that.
Well, oh, well then, well, spank me Jesus. Click, just right-click, save target on the link, principal's link for the lecture, and save target as, and then you got it down on your computer. And then you can save it to, then you can move it to wherever you want from your computer. That's very cool. Thank you. Because I thought that was always just for the address. I don't use those things that much myself. If I'm going to pirate, I'm going to do it the right way. Okay. Yeah, and there, it's, this one's got QuickTime as its player. But anyway, enough of that. Okay, now. Let me kill this off. Projector off. Is it dark in here, or did I just have a stroke? I know, right? You know, you are obsessed with buttocks, aren't you? I can understand that guy right there. I mean, are we talking prime rib? Yes.
Deflection,
you know, passive aggressiveness and all that. Okay, now let me give you a couple more. All right, here's something I want you to do right now for me. I'm going to give you a problem, and I want you to make sure that you can do this problem. Uh-huh. Okay. This isn't exactly the one that's in here, but you produce widgets. Your current level of output is 20 per week. Your weekly variable cost is $300 if your total cost is $420, what do you know about average costs and your fixed cost? You ready? Just, if you can do this, in other words, I've given you some information. What I want you to do for me is to find your fixed cost and your average costs. Now remember, total cost is variable cost plus fixed cost. Total cost over output is variable cost over output plus fixed cost over output. But that's just the same as saying that average total cost is average variable cost plus average fixed cost. Okay?